You're listening to the Safety at Work podcast, episode 118. Today we're asking the question, how should we account for technological accidents? Let's get started. Hey everybody, my name's David Proven. And I'm here with Drew Ray, and we're from the Safety Science Innovation Lab at Griffith University in Australia. Welcome to the Safety of Work podcast. In each episode, we ask an important question in relation to the safety of work or the work of safety, and we examine the evidence surrounding it. So, Drew, this is another one of your papers that you were, I guess, looking for an excuse to dive into. So why do you want to talk about what we're going to talk about today?
When you say my paper, this is not a paper that I've written. This is just a paper that I found courtesy of Ben Hutchinson, one of our PhD candidates. I guess first thing about this paper is just I'm a sucker for papers with good titles. And this paper has a great title, as we'll get to. But also, I find that some of the most interesting things in safety don't actually come from people with traditional safety or even traditional safety research backgrounds. You know, people who come in from the outside without the same sort of exposure to the literature, without the same exposure to safety practice, often have really insightful and interesting challenges to our basic assumptions. And this is that sort of paper, and I really like it. Just broadly what the paper's about, it's about the epistemology of explaining accidents. It was pointed out to me last week by another one of our researchers, Jop Havinger, that the word epistemology is really something that doesn't add a lot to any conversation that it's part of. You know, when we talk about epistemology and ontology, they're just usually jargon that don't really add to the meaning. So to put it a bit more non-jargony, when we investigate an accident, how much of what we're doing is finding out real and certain things about the world? And how much is us trying to impose meaning onto the world? That's really what the paper's asking. And it's challenging whether if we are imposing meaning, is that something that is useful to do? Is it going to lead to good outcomes from the investigation or not?
It took me about 6 months to get my head around ontology and epistemology during the early stages of my PhD. So, and how it applies, I'm still not entirely sure. But I guess it's, you know, the way the world works and the way that we think the world works, and how do we have benefit or usefulness of both of those types of understandings. So, Drew, the paper that we're going to review today, the author of the paper is Catherine Kenny, and Dr. Kenny wrote this paper, I don't know how you found this out, Drew, but wrote this paper as an honours thesis at the time of the interim report to Waterfall was released. So I assume that was around 2004 or thereabouts.
David, first of many rabbit holes in this episode is I was wondering how a PhD candidate into health sociology at University of California was writing a paper about railways in Sydney. And first thing I found out was that Dr. Kenny now works at University of Sydney. So I thought, okay, maybe she's from University of Sydney. And then I thought, why am I making assumptions? Why don't I just ask her? So I sent her off an email and she gave me a nice reply back explaining that she originally wrote this as an undergraduate assignment. And then she wanted to do a better job of it. So she expanded into an honors thesis. And then when she was a PhD candidate, they had to have a certain number of published papers for the program she was in. So she took her honours thesis and revised it and improved it again, and it became this paper. And so her career's taken her in quite a different direction. And that's not unusual that someone does their honours on one thing and then their PhD sort of leads them down a different path. But that's why this is the sort of one safety-specific thing that she's done. But she's now a very respected sociologist of health and healthcare. This was just an interesting paper that she wrote early in her career.
Right. So, Drew, the paper title that you mentioned, you're a sucker for, and we've talked about paper titles and yourself on this podcast a number of times, but the title is Blaming Dead Men, which actually has a dual meaning in this paper, but Blaming Dead Men, Causes, Culprits, and Chaos in Accounting for Technological Accidents. So the final version, I guess, published in the Journal of Science and Technology and Human Values was published in 2015. And, Drew, you dug up an interesting version of an early paper title, which to try to avoid the explicit lyrics stamp on our podcast, was titled something like SHIT Happens. I don't know how you dug that up either.
Yes. So that's what Dr. Kenny says she called it when she submitted as an undergraduate assignment, with a more academic sounding subtitle. And so, you know, the eventual version of the paper for, publication reasons was unable to use the swear word, for the same reason that, there are some other famous titles that with swear words in the title that just get cited a lot less often, because I guess people are prudes. But if instead we got this great pun about blaming dead men, I think was worth it.
So Drew, we've talked a little bit about the paper. We've talked just about a rail accident in New South Wales in Australia, and we'll talk about that shortly. And we've talked a little bit about, you know, how we ascribe meaning to certain things and how we try to understand objective facts about the world. But do you want to talk a little bit about the methodology of this paper and maybe a little bit about some of the background into the incident that we're discussing?
Okay. So the method, I guess, the best way to describe it would be a reinterpretive case study. So in other words, this is taking a particular report or a set of reports into an accident and then examining those reports as the data, not to say something about the accident itself, but to say something about how we, when we write accident reports, create and interpret meaning about those accidents. So what Kenny is doing is fairly similar to what we did in our episode 21 when we were talking about the Dreamworld report, or in episode 15 where we were talking about the Brady mining report. But obviously this is a lot more academically rigorous than any one of our podcast episodes. So David, I think you were around in the rail industry at the time of the accident. Do you want me to sort of go through the very basic facts and then you could maybe say a little bit about some of the surrounding context?
Sure. I'll do my absolute best, but it has been more than 20 years, Drew, so we'll see how we go.
Okay, so here's what we know for sure. 31st of January 2002, there's an outer suburban passenger train. So it's not like one of these big inner city, it's a four-carriage train, there's only about 40 passengers. But it's travelling between Sydney and Wollongong, which is a town south of Sydney. To get from Sydney to Wollongong, you basically go through a national park. And the train derailed at high speed near a place in this national park called Waterfall. At the time of the accident, the train was travelling at around 120 kilometres per hour. And if you know anything about Australian railways, you know trains are not meant to go that fast. Pretty much ever, I think, in Australia, we don't have trains that are capable of getting up to those sorts of speeds safely. So it's 120 kilometres an hour around a curve where the speed limit's supposed to be 60 kilometres an hour. The train overturns, goes off the edge of the curve, kills the driver, six passengers, injures everyone else on board. Some of those are just minor bumps and bruises. Some of them are really quite severe, life-changing injuries. So that's actually really all we know for sure. But the engineering investigation couldn't find anything technically or mechanically wrong with either the train, the rolling stock, the infrastructure, the track. The data logger wasn't operating. There was no evidence that the driver was deliberately doing anything wrong. So the inference was that the driver, who was in fairly poor health, must have had a heart attack. And in the process of having a heart attack, the dead man system didn't stop the train. So the their body just sort of fell onto the accelerator and the train kept accelerating. So that's it for the basics. But David, do you want to say a little bit more about either your own sort of experiences around the accident or about how the sort of technology is meant to work?
Yeah, Drew, I will. I was actually working in a central safety team in East Coast Australia rail organisation, passenger rail organisation, at the time of this event. And I was actually on the State Rail Authority, which is the operator that had this incident, but obviously an operation very close by. And I was on the task force responsible for implementing the recommendation, or at least evaluating the appropriateness of the recommendations from the investigation here into our own rail operations. So I'm quite familiar I was quite familiar at the time with the findings. But I mentioned with the paper title, the word dead man had a dual meaning. And because in this instance, we unfortunately have what seemed like a train driver that died while he was driving. And then we have, because this is a possible risk scenario on these trains, we have what's called a dead man system. So these intercity passenger trains, they operate with a single driver. So you can imagine that the risk of an incapacitated single driver is a well-understood risk. And so we've engineered systems to understand if the driver becomes incapacitated or not and take actions to safely stop the train. And this is the dead man system. So these particular Tangara trains that were in operation or involved in the train that was involved in the incident, they have two connected dead man devices. And so the driver either has to be maintaining a constant twisting tension on a handle on their console. And if they release that tension, then the dead man system will go off. Or they have to have a constant pressure on a foot pedal. And so if that pedal touches the floor or if the weight of that pedal is completely released, the spring goes off. So one of those two systems, they always have to have maintaining a constant state of tension. And I guess the theory is that if someone becomes incapacitated, their body will go limp and they won't maintain that constant tension. And then a solenoid will activate the emergency brake, which is a pneumatic braking system. It's constantly charged, that lifts the brake shoes off the wheels. And if the air in that system is released, then all the brakes activate and the train really, really suddenly, the wheels literally lock up and the train will slide along the tracks until it stops. So that's basically how this system works. And I guess, Drew, in this situation, maybe to steal the conclusion of the report, it appears as though that the slightly larger driver, even if they did have a heart attack and become completely incapacitated, the weight of their leg was able to maintain a constant pressure on this pedal. So as far as the train concerned, the driver was still driving the train.
Yeah, no, thanks for that explanation, David. The one other piece of background we should just explain very quickly is what sort of inquiry this was. So this was a special commission. Australia has a system of public inquiries fairly similar to what happens in the United Kingdom. You, depending on exactly where they happen and who authorises them, sometimes we call them special commissions or royal commissions or just commissions of inquiry. They used to be fairly rare, sort of you need to have one or two a decade. They're becoming increasingly more common. It seems like there's always some sort of royal commission or special commission going on in Australia or into something. But they have fairly strict terms of reference set by the government. And then within those terms of reference, very wide-ranging power to collect evidence and make recommendations. They get authorised. They get these, you know, each commissioner gets a letter directly from the head of state, who in Australia is either the state governor or the governor general of the Commonwealth. And usually these are run by some sort of senior judge or retired senior judge. And then they might have working for them different sorts of investigators, sometimes technical advisors. In this case, they actually had sort of like multiple technical committees that were working under the judge. What's interesting about Waterfall is the particular judge was retired Supreme Court Judge Peter McKinney. Peter McInerney. And he was also the commissioner for an inquiry into another rail accident, the Glenbrook rail accident in 1999. And it's fun reading the Waterfall report because it's pretty clear that, you know, they dragged him out of retirement. He does this one detailed investigation. And not long after he's finished that, they drag him out of retirement again. And he finds himself like reading the same documents and making the same recommendations because they haven't acted on all the stuff that he said they should do the first time. So about half of the Waterfall recommendations are about how to make sure that Royal Commission recommendations get properly followed. And one of the rules he put in place is that the government had to report every year on their implementation. And so right up to, I think, 2019, so, you know, 20 years after the accident, they're still producing annual reports on their progress in implementing the recommendations.
Yeah, Drew, I mean, in fairness, there was only a few years between Glenbrook and Waterfall. So it takes a year or two for the report to come out. And then a year later, you have this second incident.
Yes. But yeah, he was just very visibly annoyed that they hadn't taken immediate action.
So, Drew, do we want to talk a little bit where Dr. Kenny's analysis starts and then get into the paper from there?
Okay. So the Waterfall Commission produced, I think in the end, sort of three reports. There was an interim report, a draft final report, and a final report. The interim report was mainly about the physical causes of the accident. And then the rest of the investigation was basically how did those physical causes come about? So trying to explain how someone who was at imminent risk of heart failure was allowed to be driving a train and how there was this dead man system that didn't work properly that was allowed to be on the train. And so Dr. Kenny's analysis sort of starts with examining this assumption that every time you have an accident, it must have objective physical causes And those physical causes have to come from objective organizational failures. And I think that's a fairly fair representation of how we kind of think about accidents in safety. You know, we talk all the time about socio-organizational or socio-technical causes. And what we really mean by that is this assumption that we know physically what causes an accident, but that we can work backwards and say what organizationally caused the accident. And we can and should try to fix both, not just fix the immediate technical causes, but also fix what went wrong in the organization. And Kenny's just sort of examining, you know, is this assumption really true? And what sort of background view of the world do we have that makes us think that this is reasonable? And then, you know, is it in fact reasonable? So what she sort of says is that identifying the causes of accidents depends on determining what went wrong against a background of assumptions about the way socio-technical systems normally function. And that even though this set of assumptions never gets explicitly considered or examined or tested, all of the recommendations are sort of based on this ideal version of how it normally works or how it's supposed to be supposed to work. And so there's all these conclusions about how the system must have been broken in order to permit the accident to happen.
Andrew, in the paper, she goes into quite a lot of detail, historical detail on safety theory. She talks about Perot and normal accidents. She talks about high reliability organization theory. She talks about Wynn's work and really just trying to, it's actually trying to make sense of all these just different safety ideas and what they're trying to say in relation to this incident. But it's actually quite a nice sort of summary of some of these earlier ideas in safety about technological accidents.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see what people from outside of safety think are the most important big ideas to be cited in safety. And she actually sort of draws out as some of the like the biggest influences, some of the things that lots of people in safety have never heard of. So I think she manages to cite almost every one of John Downer's papers that had been written up to that point.
I thought that might have been another reason why you like this paper. We did do an episode on one of John Downer's papers about nuclear.
We've done an episode directly about John Downer and a couple of other episodes that touch on his work. And yes, I sort of find his sort of outsider perspective really quite interesting looking in at the way we tend to think about technology. The main point she's making through this literature is just how certain we seem to be with some of our safety theories about how safety is meant to work and how other fields, particularly science and technology studies, tends to see the world of work and technology as a lot more ambiguous, even down to the actual technology itself as being a lot more ambiguous. Now, this is often one of those sort of points of big contention between engineering types and studies of technology types, is engineers tend to think, okay, the technology sociologists, they just don't understand how the technology works. And if they understood it properly, they wouldn't think of it as vague and ambiguous. But then the studies of technology people come back and say, yeah, but you only think you know what it works, how it works. And you only, you know, it's a lot more ambiguous and a lot more subjective than engineers and scientists like to pretend. I have problems with that when it's applied to physics, but I think it's actually very true when it's applied to engineered systems.
And then like when we talk about going from a technological failure, if you like, and drawing a link back to, you said, a broader socio-organizational type of failure, and we spoke a bit about counterfactual reasoning in the episode with Ben Hutchinson a few episodes ago. And I think the idea in the Waterfall report that, you know, the failure of the dead man system was a result of a weak safety culture. Like, that's a long bow if ever I've heard of a long bow in going from that technological system through to something as vague and generic as a weak safety culture.
Yeah, and we'll come back to how some of those links are drawn and how valid they are. But what I like is that Kenny starts right with the fundamental question of whether the dead man system, whether there was anything wrong with it in the first place. Because, you know, the Special Commission sort of comes at the assumption that, okay, it didn't work in this particular case. Therefore, it must have been a bad system. There was something intrinsically wrong with it. Therefore, people should have known that there was something intrinsically wrong with it. Therefore, they should have fixed it and had a better system or had a second system that was monitoring the driver as well as this system.
Oh, and I also don't mind that reasoning from safety engineering point of view, because you do have a hand stick and a foot pedal, and they do activate a single solenoid that dumps the brake system. So from a common mode failure point of view, you've got one layer of protection. So the idea of having a slightly higher safety integrity level and having a second layer of protection, like, I don't mind that from a safety engineering logic point of view. Just, I guess that's something that I took out of the paper. I don't mind that engineering logic for a system that's safety critical.
Yeah, I don't mind the idea of saying we could have had a better system. And it is, in fact, directly true that immediately after the accident, the local railway authority did implement in those exact trains a second monitoring system. But there's a big jump from we can make it better and we can add something on to we should automatically have done that a decade before the accident, and we should have prioritized that over all of the other things we are prioritizing. And one of the things that Kenny points out is that this has been a controversial system from long before it was even designed. That, you know, this idea of we've got to have a system for checking if a driver is incapacitated almost always puts the burden back onto the driver to prove that they are still there. And every technology that people have come up with either involves some form of really aggressive privacy intrusive monitoring of the driver, like, you know, a camera staring in their face, or it involves the driver having to do some sort of constant or repetitive movement. And the types of systems that they'd had in New South Wales for decades and decades before this train was even designed, they had all sorts of safety problems. They had these workers experiencing chronic injury from having to continuously twist a lever or apply pressure to something. And so they knew that any time they tried to make a system that was user-friendly, it was easy for the drivers to circumvent. But any time they tried to make something that was hard to circumvent, it was really, really hard and painful for drivers. So the drivers had super motivation for finding a way to work around the system. And so they'd made quite a conscious decision. You know, if drivers are going to circumvent it no matter what we do, then let's at least make something that is comfortable for the drivers so they don't even want to circumvent it. And then we've got the best chance of not hurting the drivers and having a system that is working like it's meant to. So there was really, you know, some genuine thought and trade-off and project management decision-making that went into how they'd set up the particular system.
I remember walking around a rail yard early in my career, Drew, and if you walked around a rail yard, you saw a whole lot of brake blocks. So these are the actual unit of the brake, I guess, pad itself and the size. It's like a rectangular prism, and it's probably a few kilos. I remember asking a driver, like, why are there so many brake blocks like lying all over the floor in the rail yard? And the answer I got was they're really useful for helping drive the train. So I guess read into that what you like.
Yes. So that's in fact why this particular system, you've got to hold a certain amount of pressure on the pedal, because if you've got a system that the pedal has to be pressed all the way down to the floor, that's really easy for the driver to just put a big heavy block on. You know, if you've put a system that has to be pressed halfway, then the driver's got to find a stick that's the right perfect length in order to keep the system working. Yes, that's a true story about these systems as well.
Okay, Drew. So what else do we want to say before we are on the history of the dead man design?
So I guess the final thing to just say is that we don't actually even know whether the driver was turning the stick or pressing the pedal at the time of the accident. All of this is just assumption. We don't actually know that they had a heart attack. It's just like a process of elimination that's what we think probably happened. But they focused on the dead man pedal because they couldn't find anything wrong with the design of the switch. So they assumed that it must have been the pedal that was the problem. And here are all of the things the inquiry said about the pedal. I'll just sort of talk about the operator instead of the exact words here. So I'm paraphrasing. So the operator failed to conduct an adequate risk assessment of the pedal. The operator failed to conduct a risk assessment to determine whether the overall driver safety system would stop the train and control the risk of a train driver being incapacitated. The operator failed to do a design review of the driver safety system to determine whether the design concept would control the risk if a driver became incapacitated. The operator failed to implement an engineering management system. The operator failed to investigate whether the requirements of the driver safety system would be met by the particular design. The operator failed to prepare a functional performance specification for the driver safety system. the operator failed to determine whether the design of the driver safety system would work before the manufacturer was contracted to build the trains. The operator failed to perform a functional performance specification to identify the means by which there'd be verification of the design of the driver safety system of the trains. The operator failed to put in place a quality assurance program. The operator failed to implement a system of regular review to determine if the system was going to achieve the functional purpose. And the operator failed to conduct a risk assessment to determine whether or not a vigilance device should have been added on top of the driver safety system. So, David, that's quite a list of failures. It sounds like the operator was absolutely terrible in managing safety. Look at all the things they did wrong just for this particular device. The assumption is if they'd done any of these things, then they would have had a perfect pedal instead of this pedal that the driver of the wrong weight would fall on and might get stuck in the position. So I guess, David, you're the railway safety expert. Are there like perfect systems that do this just sitting out there waiting to be implemented for the sort of same cost and same functionality?
Look, I think everything expert is a bit of a stretch. And we've got to remember, this is 20 years ago as well, right? And these trains are manufactured a long time before that. Like these, I think this might even be a 70s, sort of 80s type design train. So in terms of functionality and cost, you know, we can look at this through a 2024 lens and we can come up with, you know, extra biometric monitoring. We can talk a whole bunch of things. The way that the railway is moving now with actual automatic track protection and European train control systems means that if the train's on a section of track doing anything other than what the train's meant to be doing on that section of track, then, you know, the system will automatically shut itself down. So, but at the time, they'd already invested in these multiple systems, one for the hand, one for the foot. And you mentioned a vigilance system. I guess after the incident, all they did was put a button on the dash where it lights up every minute or so. If it's not pressed by the driver, it makes a really audible, annoying alarm. If it's not pressed, you know, the system shuts down. You know, so they did add, I guess, quite a relatively simple system. But again, you've still got a common mode failure. You're still using the same emergency brake system and the same activation solenoid and the same, you know, circuitry and that. So I think at the time it would be easy to see that we've never had an incident with the system. I think it's okay. Just like, and I think Challenger comes up a lot in this report as well, because they liken this dead man's pedal to the O-rings involved in the Challenger and the launch decision there. So, you know, I think similar to Diane Vaughan's work around Challenger, I think another way of looking at this is that people did everything that made perfect sense to them at the time.
Yeah, no, that's a good way of putting it. So I just want to give two quick quotes, one from the way the commission talks about this, and then one from the way Dr. Kenny talks about this same thing. So the commission says, when risks such as the deficient dead man foot pedal are well known to persons in managerial positions, and nothing is done to investigate, let alone eliminate, the known risk, the inference that must be drawn is that those persons in management positions do not know how to determine what risks are acceptable and what risks are not acceptable and need to be eliminated or controlled. So that's, you know, very fixed language that the risk was there, the risk was well known, the risk was appreciated, and so the only explanation is that the managers must have been stupid. You know, they must have, even though the evidence was in their face and clear and well known, they must have still almost like deliberately made the wrong decision. Because, you know, if you accept that it was well known, then, and you know, they must have actually done something nefarious. And what Kenny says is that according to the objectivist logic of the inquiry's legalist rationality, it appeared as though warning signs of future danger had been willfully ignored. However, in the years before the waterfall accident, the level of protection from driver incapacitation afforded by the dead man system was but one of many competing objectives that the Tangara dead man design attempted to balance. Now, I'd kind of just like put both those explanations in front of anyone and say, which do you think is a more reasonable description of what these managers were doing? And I guess it comes down to if you're the sort of person who believes that like all managers are evil. But I certainly think that the first one still leaves us wondering, you know, how can we possibly make sense of this? And the second one tells us clearly how we can make sense of it. You know, either they were doing something inexplicable or they were actually acting reasonably with the information and the decisions in front of them.
Yeah, Drew, I kind of worry that more people than not would think the first description is the better one. But anyway, maybe that's where we are.
So I think the paper's got a great example. And I actually dug up the example because I wanted to check what the paper was saying about it and what the commission was saying about it.
You mean the memo? The memo?
The memo. I dug up the memo.
So just, Drew, one of the definitions said the problems or the risks associated with the dead man design were well known. And so well known is a interesting choice of words, a little bit like the deficiencies on the O-rings in relation to cold temperature launch were well known to engineers. So, Drew, the paper talks about this famous memo. Do you want to... I can't believe you went and actually read the memo.
Okay, so let me give you two things that the commission says about the memo. The first thing is they say vigilance devices should have been installed on the trains when the deficiencies associated with the dead man system were first identified by a train driver, Mr. Wilkinson, in 1988. So this is talking about the memo. The report gives three pages of analysis and discussion about what they should have done in response to this memo. And then it concludes, I've set out in some detail the lack of proper responses by these three managers to the clear warnings given by Mr. Wilkinson, none of whom tested his findings in a moving or non-static situation or attempted to speak to Mr. Wilkinson about them. I believe their attitude shows apathy in the minds of managers in the State Rail Authority at that time in regard to critical safety matters. It demonstrates a pervasive lack of concern for public safety. So, David, from that, what are you expecting this memo to say?
Look, I know the answer, so it's hard for me to give you what I would like to give you in terms of an answer to the question, but, you know, you would expect some fairly significantly compelling, almost as if like a train had actually crashed because this dead man system had failed and maybe no one was injured or killed as a result. But we have seen this happen and we've then gone and recreated the situation. We understand the failure mode and we absolutely know this is a problem.
Okay, so at the risk of making this episode run over time, I'm going to read the whole memo. And as we go through all of the details in this memo, I want you to keep in mind that this is not actually a train driver. This is a driver trainer who is not qualified to drive trains. So this is the guy who looks after the train driving simulator. And don't imagine that this is like a high-tech, perfect replica of the train. So the drivers, before they go on the train, they hop in this fairly artificial simulator. And this is the guy who looks after the simulator. He doesn't do any driving himself. And here is the memo. I find that if I place my feet at the front of the plate, the weight of my legs will hold the dead man during motoring. This can be achieved by jamming your feet under the heating. No introduction, no conclusion. That is the entire text of the memo. That after the accident, three separate managers were all supposed to have gone and followed up with Mr. Wilkinson, the non-train driving trainer, and asked him exactly what he meant. Instead of doing what they actually did, which was quite reasonably assumed that a problem that occurs deliberately by a trainer in the simulator has very little to do with how the actual system works on the actual train, and so is probably not worth spending their time on compared to other safety issues.
Wow, how to raise a safety report in 50 words or less.
He didn't even say it was a safety issue. The word safety doesn't appear anywhere in the memo or in the title of the memo. He's just complaining about the simulator.
Oh, so, okay, got it.
But what the commissioner is saying is people should have gone to him and just checked, are you complaining about the simulator? Then they should have run a series of tests, scientific tests, instead of using their own judgment as to whether they could break the system on the train in response to the memo in order to clear up this important safety issue. So this was what Dr. Kenny says instead of the commissioner's three pages about what the managers should have done. Here, McInerney demonstrates the way that an objectivist approach to technology disregards the centrality of ambiguities and uncertainties in normal daily technological operations and discounts the necessity of reasonable assumptions and is integral to the normal operation of socio-technical systems. Further, this passage illustrates the objectivist faith that further testing of technical components can definitely resolve complex and often ambiguous questions that only in the aftermath of accidents appear as simple or well-defined. So, basically she's saying that you know, the commissioner wants every single little bit of ambiguity to be traced and pinned down and investigated. And you can't use your judgment. You've got to do scientific testing, and that scientific testing will give you a definite answer. When this whole thing was a trade-off in the first place, there's no evidence that people didn't think that this was an imperfect system. It was a deliberate trade-off between systems that couldn't be circumvented but made life hell for the drivers, and systems that, yeah, had some weaknesses but were reasonably easy to operate so the drivers could get on with doing other things. I don't know, like looking out the windows and checking that the passengers are safe and monitoring the speed and looking out for red lights and, you know, all those things we expect drivers to do other than manage deliberately difficult dead man systems.
Yeah. And Drew, the language in there about ambiguities, uncertainties, trade-offs, you know, I think this in safety is, you know, so important, and we don't talk enough about it. I don't think we in health and safety talk enough about it. We definitely don't talk about it enough, you know, in senior management or executive levels of organizations. You know, the chief engineer or the project manager of this particular fleet would be dealing with wheel set issues and axle bearing issues and fire retardancy issues and rolling stock performance issues and braking systems. And, you know, there's hundreds of safety critical systems on these trains that are all in a various state of imperfection. And so, just like you said, to say we've got no information to suggest that the dead man system technically isn't working, we might have, I don't think that it's in any way irrational for the project manager of this fleet to see this piece of information come in from the driver trainer and maybe not do anything with it. And I know that people might judge me for sort of saying that, but I think that's kind of what Dr. Kenny's saying in this paper, like, just this, mate, this is just perfectly rational kind of like behavior.
Yep. Should we talk briefly about the sort of theoretical conclusions of the paper and then move on to some takeaways?
Yeah, we've talked a bit about we started with the ontological and epistemological kind of like position, and the central part of this paper is sort of having this epistemic kind of approach as a third way of thinking about accident causation. So I'm going to leave that to you, Drew, as the academic expert to enlighten me and everyone listening.
Okay, so this is drawing on John Downer's work explicitly. Kenny's not claiming to make some sort of like grand new discovery so much as pointing out an example of what Downer's talking about. And this is, there's a big push in safety to sort of move away from technical or human error explanations towards socio-technical explanations. And both Downer and Kenny are saying this move that treats our organizational systems as if they are like mechanical systems isn't necessarily a good way of looking at how organizations work. We shouldn't think of accidents as coming from failures of systems, but from failures of understanding and sense-making that may be inevitable. And this is the idea of an epistemic accident. You know, it's a fundamental inability to work out in advance things that are ambiguous. We have to use human judgment. We have to make trade-offs. We have to work with incomplete information. And inevitably, when we do that, sometimes it'll go wrong. And that doesn't mean that the system is broken. It just means that when you've got uncertainty, sometimes you get unlucky. You can make, you know, even if you've got good systems or good judgment or good people, when they're working with imperfect information, sometimes they make trade-offs and we don't like the outcomes. Sometimes they take risks and the dice rolls the wrong number. And the problem, she says, is that if we base all of our recommendations and solutions on this idea of a broken system, then we're trying to impose a solution that requires a perfect reality onto this world that still contains all of these fundamental uncertainties. So there's a really good chance that a lot of our recommendations are not actually going to fix things. They're going to run into exactly the same problems that caused the accident in the first place. One of the fun examples she draws is that in the interim report, McKinney's complaining about this lack of implementing a vigilant system. So the rail authority immediately introduced a vigilant system into the trains. And in the final report, McKinney complains that the new vigilant system, the sound it makes is exactly the same sound as one of the other alarms. And he just uses this as further evidence that they don't have a good safety culture or a good approach to risk assessment. But this is like exactly the thing that he said was obvious that should just be done. And then he complains that when it's done, it doesn't fix the problem. Because you know, the world is ambiguous, and the only way to have avoided this problem would be if, in implementing the system, they'd done proper consultation with the drivers and proper trade-off between these different systems and which system should take priority. And you can't say, okay, well, maybe they should have done all of that, at the same time as you're conducting a royal commission that didn't use a single driver as a witness in the commission.
And I think also then the inherent trade-off in, you know, needing to be seen to do something quickly and trading that off with, you know, a thorough investigation. And Drew, before we jump into the practical takeaways, I wouldn't mind just sort of saying that we've talked about this vigilance system as an action, but like with any of these, at least that I've seen these royal commissions, is from memory there was, I've got in my head a number like 43, but I'm not sure what the actual number was, but there was many recommendations from this particular investigation report. I don't know if you got the number offhand.
There were about 100, and some of them had multiple parts.
Okay, 100. We must have, I don't know, my memory of 43 must have been the ones that we thought were relevant for the rail organisation that I was in at the time. But so you then throw into this very complex, ambiguous system 100 suggestions all at once. And what's interesting in the report is when you see things like, okay, this driver was unhealthy and at risk of a heart attack, let's do a health check on all our drivers. And then the very next day, more than 13% of the state rail drivers were ruled out of medical fitness to work. So then you've got 40 cancelled train services, and you've got people working overtime and scrambling to try to figure out how you're going to operate a railway. And that's just one example of, you know, tens and tens of actions that, you know, the question is, do they actually make anything better?
Yeah, there are actually a huge number of recommendations like that. My favourite one, because I was keeping a close eye on it at the time, was he wanted all of their managers to have proper safety qualifications. And, you know, all the universities around Australia were saying, great, fantastic. You've got like 1,000 managers employed within this organisation. They all need safety qualifications. Does that like mean a huge influx of money and resources into safety education in Australia? To which the answer is, of course not. It just means the recommendation sits unactioned for 10 years and then gets closed off by saying, we've got an external consultant to tell us that our existing training is adequate and certified.
So, Drew, are we ready to talk about some takeaways?
Sure. I found finding takeaways from this a little bit hard because it's mostly just sort of challenging us about how we look at the world. So I guess I've picked some takeaways that are not so much things you can do in your own organization as just maybe some challenges to thinking about safety, particularly when doing investigations. The first one I've got here, David, is that if we want to improve safety decision-making, then we need to be realistic about how decisions are actually made instead of when we don't like the outcome of a decision going back and assuming that decisions must have been made badly or negligently or nefariously.
Yeah, I like that. I think any incident investigation needs to, you know, have a very, you know, very strong view and mindset that, you know, people did things the way that they thought they should be done and were best to be done at the time. And, you know, our objective now is to kind of understand why they did things in the way that they did, not to judge it as good or bad, but just to understand, you know, how our system was functioning to shape those sorts of behaviors and decisions.
The second one I've got is that after every accident, there's obviously going to be an incentive and a push to improve safety. And sometimes the accident has revealed a genuine immediate problem that needs to be fixed. But it's not always the case that our best investment is trying to stop the accident that's just happened. You know, often we can pour resources into trying to prevent something that was fairly low likelihood and we just got unlucky. And we'd actually do better pushing those resources into preventing a different accident or a different class of accidents rather than trying to just assume that because something bad's happened that we weren't investing enough in that particular area.
Yeah, I think that's really important, Drew. And, you know, I was thinking about that previous practical takeaway about needing to understand why people were doing things at the time, because the person could have been going, oh, you know, in 1988, when this particular memo came through, we were working on this really challenging issue around, you know, some other critical system, and we knew it was a massive problem and we had all of our resources devoted to it and we managed to solve it. And like, you could actually go to the team, well done. That seems like that was a perfect, you know, trade-off decision that you were making at the time. And then when this report lands, you know, no one in the organization gets this report and goes, okay, where do these 100 actions stack up against the things that we're already working on? And it might not be that we don't agree that it might be a useful thing to do to spend a whole lot of time on this dead man system. But if I've got to take resources off people that are doing a whole lot of other high risk stuff just because this one thing happened, then I think, Drew, what you're saying is, you know, be careful of swinging the car across the road because there might be a bigger hazard that your team are currently working on.
Yeah. I guess the particular thing I've got in mind is every single major rail accident in Australia, the recommendations have included review whether we should have a European-style automatic train protection system. And I don't know how many hundreds of millions have been spent investigating the feasibility of automatic train protection systems in Australia, and how many tentative projects have been started with partial implementations. But, you know, the fact that an accident has happened doesn't change the calculus that people have already investigated and decided not to do it. They just result in another feasibility study about whether we should do it, or a small test project of whether we should do it. And I don't want to make a judgment here about whether it's right or wrong that we've made that calculus, but we shouldn't be thinking that, you know, just because an accident has happened is suddenly going to change the minds of politicians about billion-dollar investments in rail.
Well, Drew, if it is any constellation, I know in your part of the world, in Brisbane, with the Cross River Rail project, that you will have ETCS in a reasonable portion of your network. I'm not sure how often you ride the train.
I don't know. Fun fact from the paper, though, is that Dr. McEnany apparently rode that exact model of train to and from the commission without any concerns about its safety.
There we go. Okay, third takeaway, Drew.
Okay, sometimes it's better to just embrace uncertainty. I know that's easy for academics to say because we live in more of an uncertain space, but it is okay not to know exactly what happened after an accident. It is okay not to be able to say for sure what we could or should have done to prevent the accident. It is okay to say, you know, just sometimes SHIT happens. And that doesn't mean that you don't care about safety. It's just being honest and realistic about we know what we know and don't know.
And I think, Drew, if you do find something, you know, even if you don't, you know, you don't think, hey, this might not be exactly what happened, but, you know, through the course of our discovery work, we found something, then find one thing that you might be able to do that makes a positive difference and doesn't disrupt the work too much. You know, you don't need 20 actions or 25 or 30 actions. In fact, if you do 10 things and things get, you know, seemingly better, you still don't know which of those 10 things actually helped or which didn't. So kind of like that one idea, find something and do one thing about it and kind of stop there. You know, and we should, I think we should be, with complex systems, I think we should be deliberately making probably only incremental change because we don't understand it well enough.
Yeah, imagine if after every single workplace incident or accident, we genuinely made one thing better. That would actually be probably better on average than our current hit rate of doing, spending a lot of resource on investigations and making quite a few recommendations.
And your final takeaway there, Drew?
So the final takeaway is particularly about this idea of having systems that can prevent things slipping through the cracks. I'm not a big fan of safety management systems, but having your proceduralized systems does have some value in large organizations. It stops things slipping through the cracks. And at the very least, it helps you defend and justify the decisions that you're making. But a system is never an alternative to good human decision making. Having a good system doesn't make you have better decisions, or get every trade-off right, or get your priorities right. It just creates a way of carefully documenting what decisions you've made and what priorities you've made. And lots of investigations have a huge faith in these systems being able to work. And then the next investigation just says, well, we had the system, and it still didn't solve the problem, so people must have had bad culture or not been following the system properly.
And that long list of failings that you read out in this episode of, you know, several failures of risk management and several failures of audit and quality assurance and functional specifications and, you know, design reviews and all of these things that, you know, systems that supposedly might have made a difference. But I agree with you. I think, you know, it's people that make decisions, not systems. And we need to try to help and support that decision-making as much as we can. So, Drew, the question we asked this week was, how should we account for technological accidents? Your thoughts?
So the particular view in this paper is accidents happen because people don't have perfect knowledge. And in the absence of that perfect knowledge, they're going to make reasonable decisions that in hindsight turn out to be accidents.
That's it for this week. We hope you found this episode thought-provoking and ultimately useful in shaping the safety of work in your own organisation. send any comments, questions, or ideas for future episodes to feedback@safetyofwork.com.